superintendents say they can have trouble opening in the fall if lawmakers don't come to an agreement soon over the almost two-year-long budget impasse.
We've had to eliminate about 80 teaching positions. We've closed 3 schools, you know, all just to be able to stay within our budget.
2 K-12 public school superintendents join us to talk about what they're doing to put pressure on lawmakers. Plus, we speak with 2 Chicago Tribune journalists about how top Democrats helped their friends get government jobs during the administration of former Governor Pat Quinn, and how a college course on Black music at the University of Illinois inspired those at the university to work with surrounding high school students to teach them more about jazz.
Jazz is the foundation of all the musics. I mean, every genre of music, most of them came from jazz.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If the state budget impasse meant that public schools didn't open this fall, would that make residents of Illinois care more about the stalemate? I'm talking about polling that shows about 2/3 of residents, that's based on some Paul Simon Public Policy Institute polling last fall, saying they haven't been affected by the budget. You know, we've heard everyone from political pundits to former Governor Jim Gedger say that K-12 funding could be the line in the sand. And lawmakers have been careful to make sure that funding has continued for primary and secondary public schools, even without the rest of a state budget in place. Now, some school superintendents are saying that's not enough, and they worry about reopening in the fall unless lawmakers come to an agreement on a full budget. A few have even started a hashtag, #PassILBudget, to put pressure on state legislators. I'm joined on the line now by 2 K-12 public school superintendents, Thomas Bertrand from Rochester Community Unit School District 3A, that's just outside of Springfield, and Jennifer Garrison of Sand Oval Community Unit 501, that's about an hour east of St. Louis. Thomas, Jennifer, welcome to the 21st, both of you superintendents. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Right. Superintendent Bertrand, let's start with you. How many students are in your district? What is the community like that you are in charge of in Rochester?
We are a K-12 school district of approximately 2,350 students. We're what I would describe as a bedroom community for Springfield, where about half of our residents have Springfield zip codes.
And as this budget impasse continues, how has that affected the funding that you receive from the state?
Well, I think one of the things that a lot of taxpayers don't realize is that funding for the current school year, although school districts are supposed to be fully funded with the general state aid formula, we are at a historic low in terms of reimbursements for special education and transportation cost. Of the 4 mandated categorical payments that we typically receive in a school year, we have received 1 with 2 months left in the fiscal year. We are currently in a worse state of funding as a school district than we were at any time in the previous years in which general state aid was cut.
And so, Superintendent Bertrand, if you can explain that, I know that special education funding and transportation like busing, those are obviously costs you have to cover as a district that you all are fronting. How much money does the state owe you right now for those two things in particular?
Approximately $750,000 at the last count.
Wow. And how? What percentage does that represent as part of your budget?
Well, of the transportation budget in particular, that's literally 3/4 of all state revenue that's going into that fund. And, you know, what folks don't realize is these are mandated services that we have to provide. And ultimately, they'll have an effect on all aspects of the school's program because you have to take that money from somewhere else in order to continue to provide a required service.
So that's what it's like at Rochester Community Unit School District 3A, as we've just been hearing just outside of Springfield. Let's go a little further down the state to just about an hour east of St. Louis, where Superintendent Garrison, can you tell us about Sand Oval? How big is a district do you serve?
Sure. Sand Oval, CUSD 501. We're a small rural K-12 district with about 500 students, including our pre-K. Without our pre-K, 485 students. And we have, we are high poverty. So under the Department of Health and Human Services, we're over 60% of our families live in poverty. So we're really reliant on our state funding, including the transportation and special ed payments that Dr. Bertrand referenced.
Mm-hmm. And as you were hearing him talk about that, I wonder, where are you all? How much money does the state owe you all for that?
I think always putting it, so for us, we're owed right now about $200,000. But if we think about our payroll and expenditures each month, so the checks that we have to write, we spend about $300,000 a month. So if we continue down this road and we have 12 months in a year, we will be short 1 month of being able to pay our bills. I think that is an easy way to understand it.
Superintendent Bertrand, would you say that's accurate for you as well in terms of the funding that you're about a month short?
Absolutely. At some point, school districts are going to have a major cash flow problem if this situation doesn't get addressed.
And have you, Superintendent Bertrand, what kind of cuts have you had to do in your district to deal with this?
Well, most recently, one of the issues that our Board of Education had to tackle was they made the decision to subcontract custodial services to an outside party, which was driven entirely by the economics and the fact that we've been underfunded for nearly a decade now in our state. And districts across the state are dealing with serious issues when 75% to 80% of your operating budget is invested in people, salaries and benefits. There aren't too many other places where you can cut to realize savings that's going to be required. And many districts have already made all the cuts that they can possibly make. And I think we're headed towards a real crisis here over the next 18 months if something doesn't happen on a state budget.
And how many people have you had to lay off then, Superintendent Bertrand?
Well, with the subcontracting alone, that involved 15 employees.
Mm. Superintendent Garrison, what about you all? How many layoffs have you had to have in your district?
Over the past 5 to 7 years, we've laid off about 20% of our staff, including administrators, support staff, and teachers. So we say we're down to the bare bones, just providing the basics. We no longer transport our students to extracurricular activities. All of that is on the back of our taxpayers now, parents volunteering to keep our programs going. I'm very thankful that our community has stepped up to do that. But again, the expectation of public school is that we educate the whole child, and we're missing valuable parts of what a public school should provide their students.
What else are you missing? What have you had to, Brenda, I'm thinking in particular in the past year.
In the past year?
What you've had to cut.
Since we made such drastic cuts in the previous years, we are not actually cutting this year because we are to where we don't know where else to cut besides our AP, our advanced placement, our dual credit programs, and that is what our students need to go to college. So we're in the crisis situation, as Dr. Bertrand mentioned, of if we run out of money, we cannot make payroll. That's our reality.
So will you be able to open in the fall if lawmakers don't come to an agreement? Superintendent
well,
Garrison,
saying that we have a K-12, saying we have a K-12 budget is thinking about the budget's a piece of paper, but we're not getting the money we need. So if we only receive one of the four payments due to us, we can project that we could stay open without any additional revenue to around the middle of September, maybe October.
Mm-hmm. And you were one of the superintendents. Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
It's all right. Go ahead.
We just had our board meeting this past Monday. And unfortunately, the past 3 years, this has been the recurring theme at the April, May, June board meeting of looking at our cash on hand, educating our staff. And obviously, that creates panic in teachers and parents and the community. But that's our timeline. May will evaluate if we're receiving any state money, and then we create our action plan in June, July, and August to communicate to our parents what we would need to do without any money flowing into our district, because we do not have reserves on hand at this point in time, and we're not the only district in the state. There are large districts in the state in the same boat that we're in.
Yeah, Superintendent Garrison, as you're talking about communication, you were one of the superintendents who started this hashtag pass IL budget. How did that come about?
It honestly came about with four superintendents talking over around the Easter break and just what could we do in the state to enlist as many school districts, no matter if they're a district that's in an affluent community, an urban community, a rural community, to find a common theme so our parents and our community and our taxpayers really understand the crisis that we're in Illinois. So it was a grassroots effort. It was an email blast that went out to all superintendents in the state to say, we have three principals. We need to pass a budget, not just a K-12 budget, but a overall budget. We need our payments that are currently due, and then we need to provide a funding formula that's both adequate and equitable so the money's going where it's needed most.
Now, I know you all started this on Monday. We had our social media research team look into this. We saw about 789 original tweets, around 3,500 total with retweets of this hashtag that you guys started, this grassroots effort. Superintendent Bertrand, how did you see that email and you decided to respond as well? I know we found you through social media.
Sure. Yes, absolutely. We joined in the effort to really increase awareness. And again, I think a lot of people are under the misconception that school districts are fully funded right now, and we are certainly not fully funded. And also, a lot of parts of our state have maybe been untouched by the failure of our elected officials to arrive at a budget over the last 2 years. But I think those days are coming to an end. I think people are going to feel it over the next 12 months, and it's going to be felt on the school front, where, as Jennifer alluded to, you're going to have districts across this state that are going to have some really difficult decisions to make about whether they can open their doors or whether they have to close their doors during a school year if they don't get state funding.
Superintendent Bertrand, we saw your tweet. You said Illinois schools don't need 6,000 bills introduced and 50 new mandates in 5 years. We need you to do your one job, which I assume is pass a budget. Do you have a sense that your parents within your district are understanding that message?
I think ours do, because we have a large percentage of families that are one of their parents are employed by state government, and they're feeling this impact of the lack of a state budget, and it permeates everything that they do. So I think there's great awareness here. I think there's going to be a crisis point coming here and involving K-12 schools over the next 12 to 18 months if something doesn't happen this session with a budget.
Superintendent Garrison, what about your parent population, your community population? Do you sense that they are as aware as it makes sense, obviously, that folks in the Springfield area, very tied to state government, would be? What about in Sandoval, in your area?
I'll speak for Marion County. I think the power of the Pass the Illinois budget has brought the 12 districts in Marion County together to deliver a nonpartisan message. So we are rising above the partisan politics to really talk about the facts. So they're hearing it not just from Sandoval, but other communities within our county, Salem, Centralia, to really help educate the community as a whole, because our social services are suffering, our community college, the four-year universities that our students tend to go to, we're being impacted as a whole county, as a whole region of the state. So it's larger than K-12, but it's everything our students and families depend on, specifically in Marion County, that it's like the rug's being pulled out from under us to provide the services, again, to our students and families.
One last question for both of you. When you think about the fact that it's been nearly 2 years without a budget from our state government, I wonder how that makes you feel. Superintendent Garrison?
It's hard to put in words the emotions I feel at this point in time, beyond frustrated, just unbelievable. So there's a great frustration. That's really where my emotions are. It's just unbelievable.
Superintendent Bertrand?
In a word, embarrassed that we can introduce 6,000 bills and 50 new state mandates, but we can't pass a budget. We have one job right now in our state. That's to get a budget.
As you say that, I wonder, Superintendent Bertrand, have you had a chance to talk to state lawmakers about this?
Yeah.
What have they said to you?
there's to be frank, there's a lot of finger pointing, and I just think we're at a point where we've got to set the partisan politics aside. We have to work together for the best interest of our state, because our failure to do so is going to have far-reaching and catastrophic impacts on people's lives. And, you know, Jennifer and I both work with young people every day, and I can tell you that an increasing number of our graduates are going out of our state to college, in large part because they're concerned about the future of our state. And I don't think that's a future that we want for our state, where the next generation of wage earners are going to be living somewhere else.
Superintendent Garrison, would you agree? Would you say that, and I wonder to add to sort of that question, would you say we've already had a lot of damage to the school system in particular, to your school system, to the young people that you're educating?
Most definitely. And everything Dr. Bertrand just stated, I fully agree with. And I think when we talk about the partisan politics, reflection for me is, as educators, our one goal is to prepare our children to be ready to enter workforce or college or their career. And an essential part of that is collaboration. And that's specifically what we're asking the leaders of our state, our legislators, to do, is to put the partisan politics aside and focus on collaboration to make this state great again.
That's Superintendent Jennifer Garrison with Sand Oval Community Unit 501. I want to thank as well Superintendent Thomas Bertrand with Rochester CUSD 3A. Both of you, thanks for being with me. Thanks for sharing your time with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. 3 years ago, a federal judge ordered a lawyer to look into hiring practices at the Illinois Department of Transportation. This came just 2 weeks before then-Governor Pat Quinn faced re-election against now-Governor Bruce Rauner. Earlier this week, a report on those hiring practices was released. It describes how top Democrats help friends and relatives get jobs at IDOT, even if many of them had almost no experience. The report also says that members of former Governor Quinn's senior staff were well aware of what was happening. The Chicago Tribune has been investigating the story. We've got two other reporters on the line with us to talk about this. Ray Long is an investigative reporter with the Tribune. Hal Dardick covers City Hall. Gentlemen, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Ray, let's start with you. You worked on this story with Hal and with Tribune reporter Monique Garcia. I think for a lot of our listeners, the idea that there might be some patronage hiring in state government is not surprising. We unfortunately know that is our reputation within Illinois. Can you tell us specifically, though, how this practice of hiring politically connected people at IDOT actually worked?
Well, you're right about the patronage idea. It's been going on a long time, but the rules have changed over the years, of course. So what they have here is a system at IDOT where they were putting people into what they called staff assistant positions. And they were grabbing people who didn't have various qualifications to get into those positions with what they said was little or no regard for actual hiring need or whether the candidate was qualified for the job. So they were looking to put people in places, looking to put people who were connected to other people into places. And we saw House Speaker Michael Madigan's office successfully put a bricklayer into a job that included maintaining relationships with minority road contractors. And that person eventually got into an altercation or physically assaulting a now former state legislator, and that person eventually resigned. There was another example where a representative, Lisa Hernandez from Cicero, sent in a resume of a bank manager who was put on the state payroll to inspect roads. So we had a whole bunch of different ones. Hal had some examples, too, of aldermen who were exerting different clout for basically these jobs that were not categorized for the types of of people who are getting them.
Yeah, Hal, before you chime in, Ray, can I just ask you, was this staff assistant quote-unquote position, was that a way to get around the rules then, to say if someone was a quote-unquote staff assistant, that was a way to skirt sort of practices for qualifications?
Right, that was what a way to circumvent. And so they were loading up these positions, and they really accelerated under Quinn. Blagojevich had used the methodology, but the report actually we broke two or three years ago now in the Quinn campaign showed that that the whole process accelerated considerably under Quinn.
Can we go back to Governor Blagojevich, and how can you explain how he began doing this?
Well, he was also looking for ways to put people on staff, and as you probably remember, there were a variety of issues that popped up while he was there, where we even found...
That might be an understatement, Hal, but yes.
Yeah, yeah. but on hiring... we uncovered another executive inspector report that said that basically there was not just ignorance of the law, but there was utter contempt of the hiring law. So people were not getting chances who were supposed to have a shot, like veterans who were supposed to have absolute preference. They were getting overlooked and overrun, and Blagojevich was putting people on anywhere he could.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what I think is interesting is that, you know, there were rules in place that said, you know, you can't be hired for political reasons, but there are certain positions that are exempt, a real small amount of positions. And what they do is they took one of those exempt positions and said, oh, well, these people are exempt because they were allowed to hire for political reasons in certain policy roles, but they weren't doing policy. They were doing, you know, ordinary jobs that anyone could do. So I guess it just goes to show that if someone wants to circumvent a set of rules, they might find a way. Although obviously the monitor and the state inspector general found that, you know, what they did was wrong.
And how you can you just explain also, as you're talking about that, how aldermen got involved with this as well?
Yeah, well, there's a number of people listed in this lengthy report, political people who were recommending certain people for jobs. They were making calls and so forth. We reported on one, although, you know, I got to say, Alderman Ariel Reboiras of the Chicago City Council says that he didn't do anything for his daughter, but his daughter happened to be hired. His name was listed. She was hired for a job in the Liquor Control Commission, and according to the report, that wasn't working out. They weren't happy with her there. And then they tried to recommend her for one of these IDOT jobs, and IDOT didn't want her. And then they found her a job in another state agency, the obscure to most people, the Illinois Racing Board. You know, Alderman Reboiras denies that he had anything to do with that, but you got to figure that all this pressure that was coming from the governor's office to find a post for this woman had something to do with the fact that her father was an alderman. And there are other cases mentioned in there where there's direct calls from aldermen pushing for a particular either relative or political associate.
Ray, why IDOT? Do we have a sense of why this was only happening at IDOT?
Well, one reason IDOT was a piggy bank for these types of hires was because IDOT has a separate personnel system. Decades ago, for whatever reasons at the time, IDOT set up its own kind of personnel system that was separate from the others that are overseeing and the rules that oversee most of the state agencies. And so that made IDOT ripe for opening up this kind of channel, if you will, to pour more and more of these staff assistants in. And they just kept expanding the number.
And why did this ramp up under Governor Quinn's administration, Ray?
Well, that's a question that Quinn and his people have not been very clear about, but it looks like they found a way to you know, exploit the system, and then they used it and used it more often. Now, for Quinn's side of the equation here, Ryan Croak, who was chief of staff at the end of the Ryan administration.
The Quinn administration, right.
The Quinn administration has flat out said that, you know, we did things right, and he respectfully disagrees with the idea that they knew what was going on there. But, look, there's a lot of people in state government who knew how to twist the rules if they wanted to, or exploit the little crevices in the rules to try to find people who could fit into those crevices.
Right. So to be clear, Governor Quinn did not respond to you. His former chief of staff did, to say this absolutely did not happen. What did the report say about how staff was involved in helping this hiring process along?
Well, they just basically said that it's hard to believe that they didn't know what was going on, and they used some email exchanges that more or less hinted, or very vividly hinted, that there were some ties to the Quinn inner circle.
Mm-hmm. Hal, do we have a sense of what role Ray mentioned? House Speaker Mike Madigan. Do we have a sense of House Speaker Mike Madigan, other Democrats? You mentioned aldermen. What their role was in all of this?
You know, they're allowed to, you know, I think, call and make recommendations and push things, but where it crosses the line is when they put them in these exempt positions for work that shouldn't, you know, allow for political hiring. So, you know, but they, you know, there's no smoking gun. This is, you know, they knew that they were violating the rules, but, you know, they were certainly playing the system in an old way that I think most politicians know, because of all kinds of court rulings, Shackman in the city, Rutan at the state, that system is declared illegal by the state. You're not supposed to do business that way because you're not giving taxpayers the best services as a result. So, you know, it's folks crossing a line that they know is no longer permissible.
Mm-hmm. That's we're speaking with Hal Dardick, a City Hall reporter for the Chicago Tribune, on the line with us from the Tribune, along with Ray Long, who's an investigative reporter. Ray, I noticed there was a way that staff would, I guess, cryptically forward resumes to IDOT. How did that work?
Well, they had various systems set up where they would hook up. It was basic. I'm trying to think of the best way to say it, but they basically allowed IDOT and a couple other agencies to see candidates that were more or less favored, if you will. Those are my words, but to cut through it all, they were then able to try to move them along.
Right, because they didn't actually have emails that said, hey, you should hire this guy, obviously, because you can't, that's FOIA-able, anything a state employee does is, but would they forward emails, how would they do this? They would forward emails with just words like, see attached? Is that kind of what they used to do, right?
You know, what's up, you know, what's up with this latest hire, you know, people are interested, inquiring minds want to know, those kinds of,
okay,
of phrases.
Right.
So,
there was one email in an alderman's case where it said, you know, the alderman did call and was asking about this. It didn't say you have to hire him because the alderman wants him, but... You know,
right, he said alderman so-and-so is calling about this hire, what's going on?
Right.
Okay. And how much of this, based on the report, how much of this, Hal, you got to some of this, how much of this is legal and allowed versus clearly crossing a line, Ray?
Well, they believe that a lot of them, if not most of them, if not all of them, were actually done in ways that shouldn't have been done. So they've already eliminated some of the people who landed these jobs in as staff assistants. But Rauner has also now come back and said that he wants to fire two or three dozen more who are still on state jobs. They started in these staff assistant jobs, and then they got moved to another job that is protected by various union and civil service contracts and regulations. So these staff assistant jobs were basically at will where they could fire them. But then if they start there, they have kind of a holding place, and then they move to another job that could be protected. So it was also used as kind of a, you know, like an airplane circling an airport waiting to land somewhere else. That job at IDOT was
with state worker jobs. Ray, can I ask how much, do you have a sense of how much this has changed under Governor Rauner? He certainly made lots of speeches and had lots of conversation, and certainly has implemented some rules that he says are specifically aimed at corruption and patronage and these sorts of things.
Yeah, there have been changes. In fact, the report mentioned that Rauner had made some changes. You know, it's so convoluted, it's hard to really get a total judgment call for me to make there. But the report itself did say that Rauner had made some changes that improved the situation. And now he's trying to go after the jobs of the people who he contends were illegally hired through this system, or at least hired through a circumvention of rules and regulations before.
Let me ask both of you one last question. We just have a couple minutes left. Hal, you've been covering City Hall for some time, and I want to ask, wonder what your sense of what you think about our state's political system is, what you learned about it, what your impressions of it are after this report.
Oh, I don't know if the state's all that different from the city, and it also depends on who's in charge. I do think that under this current mayor, probably because politically he doesn't need to, there isn't the kind of patronage that occurred.
Right, the whole machine that Chicago is.
Sort of political system going where he's funded by financiers and other people, and that's how he works. But I'm not, you know, the state, I mean, it's sort of deja vu. Looking at the state as compared to things I've seen in the city.
Yeah, because, I mean, obviously Chicago's sort of infamous.
In the state of Illinois,
right. Yeah. Chicago's kind of infamous for this. Ray, I wonder what your sense is. I mean, you were in the state house for quite some time. Does any of this surprise you? Is it depressing? I'm curious your sort of characterization. What do you think, Ray?
Well, it's just amazing that it continues to go on. No matter how many courts rule, no matter how tight they try to draw the rules, there's always somebody trying to get around them. And they can argue, well, we played by the rules, but they are certainly bending the rules at various times. And they can argue that they didn't know anything about it, but the court monitor has doubts about that conclusion.
That's Ray Long. He's an investigative reporter with the Chicago Tribune. I want to thank his colleague Hal Dardick as well, City Hall, for the Tribune. We will tweet out the links to that story if you follow 21st Show. Ray, Hal, both of you, thanks so much for being with me and explaining all of this report. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Stay tuned on the 21st. We're going to be talking about an idea that a U of I professor had. Why not integrate local high school students into a history of black music course? That resulted in a concert. We're going to bring you a little audio postcard from that concert. Talk to the professor and graduate student behind that idea coming up on the 21st. Stay tuned. Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When University of Illinois professor Mark Hertzman began his History of Black Music course this semester, PhD student Marcelo Cuyujian had an idea. Why not integrate local high school students and have them participate in a jazz concert? Over the course of the past month, the high school students worked alongside Marcello and college students from the Black Music Course to prepare for a Central High School Jazz Fest, which they performed in last Friday. Our intern, Abar Alhiti, went to the concert and brought us back this story.
Marcello Cuyumje is getting his PhD in musical arts at the University of Illinois. He teamed up with history professor Mark Hertzman to go beyond the classroom for a course on the history of Black music.
I had this idea of trying to do a project with high school students. It's important for us to support the music teachers here in this area, especially trying to give them, the students, a little bit more of a broader view of music.
Instead of just talking about the music, the idea was to get out into the community and share the music with the younger generation.
Lily Benny Hashem, I go to Uni High, and I play piano.
I'm Donovan Paris, and I go to Urbana High School, and I play the drums.
Lily and Donovan were two of the 10 high school students who performed. Lily, who's a student at Urbana University High, said learning to play jazz piano was a new experience.
I had never played jazz piano before. I had no idea how to do it, so I think I learned a lot about jazz and its history, so that was good.
After a few weeks of practice, high school students from five different Champaign-Urbana area schools played selections studied in the class.
Jazz is the foundation of all the musics. I mean, every genre of music, most of them came from jazz.
Jonathan Foster is a University of Illinois sophomore studying civil engineering. He helped teach the students to prepare them for their performance.
I didn't always listen to jazz. The only reason I listened to jazz was because I played jazz in high school. And when I played jazz in high school, I was very sad that it was a very contained sort of event. Like, we just stayed in the classroom, we played jazz, we left, we performed. So I really enjoyed an opportunity to interact with other jazz musicians and learn more about what you can do as a jazz musician.
Hertzman says they hope to expand the collaboration with high school students in the future.
I mean, the fact that Marcel has been able to bring in these high school students who have, like, gotten his amazing lectures, had discussions, and now are going to be culminating in this concert, that itself is awesome.
A few voices and music from last Friday's performance. Thanks to Abral Akiti for bringing us that sound. We just heard from Marcello, the graduate student who teamed up with University of Illinois professor Mark Hertzman to make that performance happen. Both of them are in studio with me now. Marcello, Mark, thanks for being here. Welcome to the 21st.
Sure. Thank you.
Great to be here.
So, Marcello, you can hear in the tape how enthusiastic the students seem to be. Were you surprised by how they responded? Is this what your intention was?
Yeah, a little bit. I knew they were all involved with music, so I was expecting that, but they all were really great. They were really excited about having the chance to play a little bit more. So that was something a little bit of a surprise for me.
Yeah, Mark, was it when you when this whole idea came about? I don't know what you thought would happen, but I'm wondering sort of what your thoughts were after last Friday's concert.
The concert was amazing. I was just blown away. Marcello always does amazing things, but it was remarkable to see the students come together and play such an amazing set. So it was fantastic. You know, I had high expectations, exceeded them.
Yeah, Mark, why did you start this History of Black Music course?
So the course itself, I've taught a version of it. It's the first course I ever taught after grad school. I have a longstanding history in music and race and how the idea of Black music came to be. Here, you know, the main intention was kind of within the history department to have a course that shows that history is not, I mean, most of our courses show that history isn't just reciting names, dates, and memorization, that it's really a way to engage with the current world and to understand it in context.
Yeah. Marcello, for you, how did you first hear, did you take the course? How did you first come up with the idea?
Mark is a co-advisor of my wife. She's a PhD student in history program. And I knew he had done research on Brazilian music, so we've been in touch for a while. He's now helping me out with my own research project. And then when I heard that he was going to teach that class, I had some interest in doing some kind of a collaboration with professors here on campus. And then I thought that would be a good opportunity to do that.
Right, right. And what did you think in terms of the high school students that you thought that you would approach? Why did you think high school students in particular?
Well, I just always felt that there was a need of for our campus community to reach out to high school students. I just think our jazz program here has such a great structure in terms of great faculty, some very, very talented undergraduate and graduate students. And I really thought that high school students could benefit a lot from being in contact with us. I have a few private students that I teach piano lessons, and I noticed they were not having as many opportunities to perform. So that was the thing. And then when Mark told me about that class, I thought that would be a good way also to give them a little bit of an historical context that they're not having their school ensembles as well. So mm-hmm. those are two things that we were trying to accomplish that way.
What are you doing your PhD in?
It's actually called a DMA because it's a performance, mm-hmm. it's a doctorate performance in jazz studies, and I'm a piano player.
Uh-huh, and you're a piano player.
Yeah.
How did you first get it? When did you first hear about jazz? What was your first experience with jazz?
It was with a friend in school. In Brazil, we don't have school in music like in here. So I had a friend who was playing trumpet, and he started getting interested in it. My uncle is actually a jazz drummer. He was living in São Paulo at the time, an hour away. And when I told him, oh, I have a friend who's trying to teach me this, like, can you give me some pointers? And then he started bringing me almost every holidays I would spend with him at his home. And we would go to listen to some music I heard him playing. So that's kind of how I got involved into it.
And Mark, how about you? You said you've been teaching this course you've been teaching not just jazz. This is a history of black music, right? So this goes back. I don't even know how does that start?
How does it start? It's a long story. But my research originally, my first book was about the history of samba music in Brazil. This goes back to grad school. My interest, obviously, in music goes back, much further, to when I was young. Yeah, so there's sort of a long history. One of the neat things that I think we try to do in the course at the beginning is try to get students to think about where their own interests come from and sort of what are the pathways through which they get to like the music they like. And I find in these conversations, it's almost always parents and school is sort of some of the first ways, and not just radio and internet, but
right, people, but their families and having the music right. And so I guess for both of you, did you think this was a good opportunity? It was interesting to listen to the students, Donovan and Lily, two of the high school students who I guess felt like they kind of knew about jazz, but obviously were more. And I know some of this didn't end up on air. I heard some other tape talking. They talked about, how much they loved hip hop and all of these other things and didn't really understand sort of the influence of, for example, jazz and all of that. Mm-hmm. Marcelo, was that a big part of what you wanted to teach them as well?
Yeah.
Sort of experience or have them experience?
Yeah. So I think one of the main issues we have with jazz education today is that it's becoming almost like a sort of museum music where you just learn about it from the past, but you can't really connect it to the present. And hearing that he was teaching that course, I thought it was a good opportunity to show them the connections with hip-hop, which is a music that a lot of people listen to today, and then also connecting that to funk, soul, and R&B, to show kind of the lineage. And in schools today here in the United States, and especially here in Champaign, most people have contact in terms of popular music with jazz, but not so much hip-hop. So one of the professors who came to talk, Adam Cruz, his whole project is about trying to develop programs of hip-hop in public schools. So the idea is, how can you take this music that you're learning in school and connect it with the music that you actually like to listen to? And I think that was one of the goals we were able to accomplish.
Yeah, Mark, did you find that with the college students as well? That's part of what you're trying to do with the course too?
Yeah, absolutely. And I have to say that one of the posters for the course has a picture of hip-hop. Has a picture of Jay-Z with performing with the Roots. And as you get into the course, I think a lot of people take the course. They want to have Jay-Z and they want to have hip hop, and we do a lot of that. But the course also really tries to open them to not just sort of precursors in the U.S., but we do music in Brazil and Cuba and Japan and in different parts of Africa. Hip hop in some ways is kind of a hook that then gets them into a deeper history.
I mean, is that a tough thing to do when you're doing music education? I'm just thinking about what Marcelo said about, we kind of think about whenever you say history of music, I think you do think it's sort of like a museum. You do kind of put music into a historical context as opposed to thinking about what's happening now, the music that's being played now, all of those influences. How hard is it to do that in a course?
Yeah, I think it's actually that aspect coming from a historian is in some ways easier because, kids really want to learn about, they're interested in the material. So one of the things that I know was important for Marcelo and myself was to put Black Lives Matter at sort of the center of this and to really have it be important. And, the students, this is one of the most engaged.
Yeah, how did you do that?
Yeah, so.
When you think about the music of Black Lives Matter, of course, I'm thinking about like Janelle Monáe and different, but what particularly how did you do that?
Right, so two ways, I guess, in particular. I mean, one is we've tried throughout the semester to think about the civil rights movement and sort of other historical precedences in connection to, but also in differences between what we're doing today and what we see today and then. And then also, we've actually focused on, so this week, for example, we talked about in class Colin Kaepernick and the anthem. We've done a lot of discussions of and the Black National Anthem and sort of performances around the anthem and national identity and racism. Yesterday, we were visited by the local hip-hop duo, which is now a trio, Mother Nature, and they are very engaged with Black Lives Matter. So we're trying to do it, you know, in a number of ways, both historically and then also just connections to things going on today.
Marcelo, when you talk to the students, I know you were mostly working with them on music, but do you get into kind of these conversations with them about protest and music and how that is influences art these days?
So in this program, we had meetings on Saturdays where the first part of it was a lecture. So we did talk about it a little bit, and then the second part was a rehearsal. The lectures went a little bit longer than I was expecting. Now that's bad, but I was hoping to have some more time while we were playing to discuss those things. Because we had so such long lectures, which I think was actually really great, in the time we were rehearsing, we really needed to focus more on the music. So unfortunately, it was a little more separate than I was hoping for. That's something we might want to.
What kind of things did you lecture? What did you talk about in the lecture?
So we had three lectures. The first one was about sampling in hip hop and how a lot of hip hop artists are sampling from records of soul and R&B and jazz. To show that historic connection, talk about how they're thinking about music and also where they're drawing their ideas from. The second lecture, so that was Professor John Myers from African American Studies. On the second Saturday, we had Adam Cruz from Music Education, and he's talking about his project of why is it that we don't have hip-hop in schools, the concepts of appropriateness of music in public school settings. And his whole research is about, on his doctoral research, he looked at one hip-hop artist who dropped out of school. And his question is, why is it that there's this kid who loves music? He became a professional musician.
A great writer, loves to write, sure.
But in school, he didn't have any success in music and ended up dropping out. And the third lecture was Gabriel Solis from Musicology. And he talked about kind of a history of Black liberation movements. Focusing a little bit more on civil rights and how that connects to jazz that was being made in the 60s. So we did have a lot of...
Now, we heard a little bit of Stevie Wonder. What music did you pick for the students to play?
We played I Wish and Signs You Delivered. And the second one, actually, I didn't know. I've been trying to learn more about Stevie, and I have a student, a high school student, who showed me most of those tracks. So Daniel Austin from Judah. So that's been a good exchange that I've been getting from them as well.
Yeah, Mark, what was sort of the goal for you? What were you hoping to have the college students get? It was interesting to hear that engineering student in the audio piece that we heard say, hey, when I was in high school, I didn't really have people I could kind of hang out with and talk about this. So this was cool to do this with high school students now that I'm in college.
Right. Yeah. You know, something happened yesterday sort of in class with the when Mother Nature came that really I thought was great. I mean, part of what we want the students to do is to think historically, obviously, and contextualize. Also to think about how hip hop and different forms of Black music can create limiting narratives. So we've talked a lot about how difficult it is to be a woman in hip hop, how difficult it is to be mixed race and all these kinds of things. But somebody asked that question to one of the to Truth, one of the members, and she identifies as a Black queer woman, and she said, I don't give an F about it. And it was really kind of it was an amazing moment. I think that we've been talking about sort of limitations and all this, and this was really an inspiration. She came from Illinois, came out of the system that these students are in, and is doing something really remarkable despite a lot of challenges. So, and that I would say I didn't necessarily see coming into the class, but was a really great way to, as we and go to the end of the semester.
So this is work. Are you guys going to do this again? Are you going to plan to have have more high school students involved and maybe do some more of these concerts?
Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah, Marcelo always has big plans. He has some big ideas for next year. But yeah, I definitely want to keep this going. It's just great for everyone, I think.
All right. Well, thanks so much for being with me. That's Mark Hertzman is an associate professor. He's also the director of undergraduate studies in the Department of History at the University of Illinois. Marcelo Kujuman, did I say that right? Who's also at the UIC, at UIUC in music. Thank you both for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.
That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app if you search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have the NPR One app and you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, and every other way to contact us if you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, follow us on social media. It's all on our website, 21stshow.org. By the way, on our Facebook page, if you search for The 21st to like us, you can comment on what we're working on. You can also post questions or comments you want us to ask on air. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.